Welcome to Present Company, the Netflix podcast that brings you dynamic conversations with exceptional people behind your favorite series, films, documentaries, and specials. I'm your host, Krista Smith. For years, I was Vanity Fair's ambassador to Hollywood, interviewing countless actors as well as creatives and authorities across the spectrum. My passion is talent, any form of it. How do you know you have it? How do you cultivate it? How do you protect it? And also, I want to get to the heart of what drives it. On this podcast, I'll be talking to people in Hollywood and far beyond. Thank you for joining me.
Thinking about the people in America who, by the way, this show is a love letter to them. It's a wake-up call for them. In that we are reminding our culture what our mission statement was. You know, we are post-war babies who pulled ourselves up and realized that we live in the greatest country in the world and we could do whatever we wanted to.
That was RuPaul and Michael Patrick King, who both joined me in the studio today to discuss their new show, AJ and the Queen, a heartfelt, gritty comedy in which Ru stars as Robert Lee, better known as the drag queen Ruby Red, who, when faced with a broken heart and a stolen dream, meets a streetwise 10-year-old and takes it on the road. Michael Patrick King's vast body of work includes the juggernaut that was Sex and the City, not to mention Murphy Brown, Will and Grace, Sybil, The Comeback, and Two Broke Girls. And RuPaul's career achievements could fill an encyclopedia. You know them all. The RuPaul Show, RuPaul's Drag Race, RuPaul's Drag Con. The list goes on and on. Between them, they have left an indelible print on our modern pop culture. They've influenced the way we talk, the way we dress, the way we think about relationships, the way we talk about identity, the way we contour, even the way we brunch. In this conversation, we talk about what drives them, how they maintain the pace, their passion, their purpose, and what makes their creative partnership so vital. We're jumping straight in here, people. Mama Ru waits for no one, so buckle up, keep up, and enjoy the ride. We're ready whenever you are.
Yeah, let's hit it.
Yeah,
let's
we're hitting it. Ready?
Yeah, I've been looking at pictures. I've been posting a lot. RuPaul here. I've been posting a lot of pictures on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of I had someone transfer a lot of my old photographs to digital a few years back, and I never looked at them. But mm-hmm. recently, I've been looking.
Are
at
Are they
them.
Able to do that with kinescope?
Yeah, they can do that
with tin
the kinescope. Yes, you know, Sid Caesar and I were talking just the other day. I'm finally posting these pictures, and I'm seeing these pictures. Some 35-year-old pictures. And I think, boy, am I tired. Boy, have I just been working forever.
Well, that leads me into a really good question, which was, I'll just start with it. You two, you don't need to do anything else ever in life. You don't need to do anything else. And yet, and I think about MPK over here, that's Michael Patrick King. You guys have already heard Ru talking. You know, what you've accomplished between Sex and the City and Two Broke Girls, and I was reading that the DVDs alone of Sex and the City sold north of $300 million, okay? Your Emmys, your show, your everything. Why did you decide to get more tired and create a brilliant, funny, heartwarming, I loved every second of it, didn't want it to end, show AJ and the Queen? Because that shit is not easy.
Right.
And you not only did it, you didn't just do like song and dance and isn't this cute, you really fucking did it. So we're on the road, we're in and out of drag, we have a kid, we have like lots of characters, we meet a ton of people along the way. Why? Why now?
Well, first of all, let me just answer the first part. I complain about, boy, am I tired. I've been working so much. The alternative is actually even worse. You know, to do nothing is really death to sweet, sensitive souls. And I speak for Michael too, who this life can be very boring and drudgery if we don't keep moving. So why do it? I have to do it.
I have one addition to that. There is something worse than doing nothing. that is doing something that doesn't matter, that you don't care about, that you're going and you're exhausted and you're, because you know it takes just as long to do something you don't care about as something you do. So to be trapped in a situation where you're killing yourself and it doesn't engage your heart and soul, and you're not laughing or you're not amazed or you're not seeing music, there is a worse thing than doing nothing. And there's nothing, absolutely nothing exhausting about being exhausted on something that is like this show, which was just always out of our fingertips. Like we worked with Joni Marchenko, and she said to me once, we were watching Rue do, I think the number when he was a chandelier or something, and she goes, "Honey, I don't know what this is, but whatever the hell it is, it's thrilling." And I felt that the reason to the simplest answer to why is Rue for me. The fact that RuPaul showed up and said, literally without using these words because it's too corny, "Do you want to play together?" Is the only reason to do this. And then when you have a playmate like Rue, you really want to use all the Crayolas. you want to color with everything in the box. You want to use all the crayons, the periwinkle blue and the gold and the sky blue. And in most television, you get to use primary colors. And with him slash her character and this life that we've sort of lived as people and artists, we got to really open up to this thing. And it was exhausting because we went supposedly across the country. And he, I've never seen anybody do what he does. And I've worked with a lot of people, but I've never seen anybody. I mean, my favorite thing about Rue is he refuses to fail. Even when he's failing, he will somehow, like, you know, like, what's the movie where the guy did the sheer rock climbing? I can't remember.
I think
you know,
it's called The Rock or something.
No, and
Free Solo.
Free Solo, yeah. And you would just think, how is he getting his finger in that thing and pulling himself up? We had a couple of scenes where Rue, I mean, this is all new to you. I mean, like pages and pages of dialogue going into drag, going into heartbreak. And I would see him sliding down the face of the cliff of this thing. And somehow, I'm not hitting the ground. He'd
get
his nail or his heel into it and hold himself there and then pull him up and do the best he can, which is all you really want if you're going to kill yourself. You want somebody who's also killing themselves.
I absolutely agree. And, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about the people in America who, by the way, this show is a love letter to them. It's a wake-up call for them.
How so?
In that we are reminding our culture what our mission statement was. You know, we are post-war babies who pulled ourselves up and realized that we live in the greatest country in the world and we could do whatever we want to do. And that at our heart, at our core, America is absolutely a lovely place with good, lovely people. And we've somehow gotten off track. And this show, AJ and the Queen, is a love letter. It's a wake-up call to sort of a gentle nudge to awaken that beautiful beast, that beautiful American beast.
And we tried to show as much as we could of what's next in the world, rather than what we have right now. That rather than thinking of AJ and Ruby, the queen, as misfits, maybe just think that everybody fits. And that as we wrote, when we were writing and we went across the country in our heads, and they meet everyone from trailer parks to wet t-shirt contests, we were very, very aware of not pushing anyone out of the story. Like not saying us and them, but saying us. And even, you know, the parable of this drag queen who thought he had it all together and was all ego. And the universe served him up a big disappointment that the next person to help him along his path is this 10-year-old girl masquerading as a boy whose mother has an opiate problem. And the idea that that contrast is in the world and that the tall one has to learn from the small one, just like everybody learning from each other. Like, anyway, they're walking down the street and he says to her, you know, she's afraid he's going to get beat up in Ohio because he's gay with big boobs in Ohio. That's her line. And he says, you know, for someone so smart, you have a very limited view of the world. People are more complicated. So subliminally, within the big rubber boobs and the heels and the drag and the little kid in Jimmy Cagney drag, this little tough little shit, we're trying to say, open up, open up. Stop thinking of us as two separates or 1,700 separates. You have a speech at the end about, like, we're all in drag, which is, of course, back to Rue, why you do it. The philosophy that everybody's in drag is really interesting, and you can change your drag. He even says that to Jane Krakowski's character.
You can change it. For you, you're an actor.
I think we all are.
I know, but you're really an actor. I mean, I know I'm an actor. When I have moments, sometimes I give my best performances and no one's watching.
Right now? Right now? Is this it?
Like now. I've got an audience.
Are you sure this is genuine?
But
seems so.
You're a real actor now. You are giving a range of emotions. You have no makeup on. We're seeing you I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but like we've never seen you before. And I only say that because when you're in your drag, when you are in RuPaul's Drag Race, or when you are performing, there is nothing that is left for, there's no detail that you haven't covered. The hair is a certain way, the look, everything is so controlled. And yet, you're completely out of control as the actor and as a person. How was that for you as just RuPaul doing that, like as you're sitting here right now looking at that dialogue, knowing you're going to have to do that day?
Well, you know, I felt safe with Michael, and he created an atmosphere where I knew that I would be fine. In fact, years before, I played myself on The Comeback, the brilliant show, The Comeback, and he made a small adjustment for me, and it made so much sense to me. I went, oh, of course, of course. And in that moment, I thought, oh, this is someone who not only is super talented, but smart, and is paying attention to every aspect and every detail. And I felt safe with him. So when my agent called and said, hey, you know, it's probably time for us to hook up with a writer. He said, who do you want to? I said, Michael Patrick King. Let's call him up. Called him up. And within 15 minutes of meeting him, we'd met before, but of meeting with him, AJ and the Queen was born. Within 15 minutes of our meeting.
That's amazing. Where's the commonality other than like were there film references or television or thing? Okay, so give me a little bit of that.
The beginning of the meeting was I was like a minute late, which I never am, and I walked into my office and Rue was there, prompt as he always is, in a bird of paradise suit. burned into my memory.
Yeah.
He was sitting under a photograph I have in my office, which is a big black and white still from Preston Sturges's Sullivan's Travels. And he said, that's my favorite movie. And I said, that's my favorite movie. And the thing that's important about why we like that crazy movie is, first of all, it travels from African-American cook in an RV trying to make pancakes, hitting potholes and getting covered in flour, that kind of Maxenic clown, to this higher place, which is this Hollywood director thinks it's time for him. It's the Great Depression. There's hobos. Everybody's broke. Everybody in the country's broke. Everybody's down and out. He thinks his job, since he's a director, is to make an important movie about the pain of the world. So he goes on the road with Veronica Lake, and what he realizes when he's arrested and put in a prison, that they take them to see a movie, and it's a Mickey Mouse cartoon. It's the only time he saw any of these down-and-out prisoners smile, and he realizes, well, if you have the gift and you can make something, maybe what you should do is make people smile. If that's your thing. That's what he's been doing. That's what I try to do, is just lift it up. What do you try to make something smile? So that's the connection. That, I don't know if you know this, but we're both gay. That's another connection.
I never would have believed. I just would have said,
we're both
like...
in our 30s.
P.S.
1930s, that is, darling. That's a connection. We're both scrappy. Both came from nothing. Both, I'm going to qualify mine, but both made our way. He made his way, clearly. There was no place for him. So he, once again, found a way to get in the wall that doesn't open.
Yeah.
But that's a connection.
That's the connection. And it's so lovely to be able to volley and play with someone who's on your level of volleying, you know, just like this.
Are you attempting a sports reference?
I'm doing a sports reference.
I'm loving it.
I'm not doing it very well, but
volleying, it's close enough.
Yeah.
But I get what you're saying.
And it's so good. It seems harder and harder to find good volley partners from time to time. I've been lucky in my life, my career, to still work with the kids I know from the East Village. Mm-hmm. We've been doing it forever. And in that moment when Michael made a small adjustment on me at the comeback filming, I thought, here's one. Well, he's got it.
Okay. You know, he went right off the really interesting question about what's it like for him to be vulnerable in an actor.
So you can answer that.
And there was no small adjustment in this. I mean, Rue had, it was really interesting to see him, good morning, now you're going to go into the RV and fall apart. And the cameras are going to be right on your face. And there's no lighting. And there's no glamour. Mm-hmm. And he's like, ready. And he came ready. And the one thing when we were going out, we came up with our version of the show. We were like, yeah, we know what it is. And we were at a meeting right before we went out to sell it. And I said to them, him checking in with the DNA of what we were going to sell, is there anything about this show, the idea of this show, that worries you? And he said, yes. Can I do it? And I said, the fact that you asked that question means we don't have a problem. You were never pretending you knew what you were going to be able to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a surprise how much, it just kept coming.
Yeah, yeah. I felt safe. And it was such a surprise because, you know, I'm not dead inside, as I had assumed. You know, you live this life and you stay in this town and you try to survive in this town. And there are parts of myself that, you know, have had to shut down and to not be emotionally affected by it. And this calls on me to bring all that up. And I was prepared. And that was a beautiful surprise and a gift from this whole project.
One of the extra other part of this is that you perform in every episode, which we have not seen you do that.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the last time.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
When he's doing the wet t-shirt contest,
Rue
is looking at the first cut of it and he goes, ooh, people haven't seen her since New York in the 80s. I mean, he was just like, oh, I'm that's there.
Yeah.
And the Daisy Dukes and the halter top.
Yeah.
And also, it's really important that he perform.
Yeah.
Rue is like a very old-fashioned in his give the people what they want. So if he's crying in one scene, he would say, oh, that's my first attempt at ever doing you. Oh, we should put a number here. So then they can go back on the second time and just watch the musical numbers.
Right.
That will be fun for the audience. Yeah. And then we should do music too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Old-fashioned.
How did you decide on the red wig and the ruby red and all that? Because I know the names are very important.
Well, you know, actually, Michael said asked that question. And
I said, literally, how are we going to steal what you've already perfected, but change it so that people don't think it's RuPaul? What are we going to, like, I asked this big artistic Adam splitting question. And what did you say?
I said, well, just wear red hair.
He actually said with a raise of, maybe she's not blonde.
Yeah.
And then I said, what could she be? Said red.
Yeah.
And then it all comes from there. Red.
And that's it, just as simple as that.
Maybe she's not blonde.
Because you've had, 11 seasons, tons of Emmys, is blonde.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
Mama Roo.
Was it 11 seasons? I can't remember.
I think you're in your 11th season, however you count it, like in dog years, I'm not sure. But
we started the show right after the Korean conflict.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
And then the beauty cons and all that. So I see how you guys, just looking at you, I see how you work, obviously, a little bit creatively. What happens when you butt heads or your challenges? How do you get through that?
Do we butt heads? It feels all creative to me, even if we've disagreed. Now, you've twisted my arms a few times.
Yeah. I mean, I think, here's another, I think a big journey, aside from Ruthie, the actor, which is already there, there's another big journey which was very interesting, which is Rue's drag is a thing unto itself.
Mm-hmm.
And if I was making a ballet analogy just to balance off his volleying sports analogy, Rue's, as Mama Rue, if that's what people are going to identify that character as, is a prima ballerina.
Mm-hmm.
The end. That exists on its own everything. It's a prima ballerina. To ask the prima ballerina to be in the court of ballet, which is what you have to do. Because Rue's it's really, drag is magic, don't you think?
It is
magic.
It's
like you don't want to stay too long.
Yeah, right.
You want to show it and go.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's shot from the front.
Mm-hmm.
Rue said, I'm only shot from the front. I was like, yeah, that's over. That you know when I'm in drag, I'm only shot from the front. And he goes, yeah, that's over.
Yeah. With the perfect lighting.
And I said, then we have Ed Pei was our cinematographer, who I said, you'll look amazing and you'll look real and you'll be drag when you're supposed to be drag. But the idea, the first time I you said to me, what are we doing? He was in Tucked, and he said, let's go. I said, we have to turn the lights around. It's going to take 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And Rue was like, I just can't be sitting here.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't like I'm too good to sit here. It was like, I can't be showing the thumb where the magic scarf goes for 45 minutes. I'm not used to being exposed as sitting in. You said I can't sit in a chair for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And wait. And I said, that's the fastest crew I've ever worked with. You have to.
Yeah.
Movie acting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, a beard is growing back. Things are tucked. Things are glued. Mm-hmm. Especially when, there are hot lights and stuff.
It's rough.
Things come undone and, you have to go back and fix them.
Yeah.
You know?
And then there's another half hour.
Yeah.
So anyway, Rue sat in the chair. This is early. This is episode 3, which is really up front. Rue sat in the chair and then it was time for him to do this gigantic wet t-shirt contest number where he had to get wet and stuff. And he gave it all. And when we thought that's enough, he looked at me and he said, let me freestyle one for you.
Yeah.
And I felt personally that was a give for the 45 minute, that little moment. And that was the only time I ever thought, oh, how are we going to do this with the drag, not with Rue as Robert?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Also, I think I think that having done this work for so long, I think in terms of the editor, I think of, okay, what are we going to give the editor to work with? How are we going to make this interesting? So I always want to do a freestyle one. I always want to give a little bit extra. And,
but so few people do want to give a little bit extra. And when you're already a little bit extra and you still want to give extra, that's why you do it. But the music is also, that was really fun too, because that's something he has that I don't really
I know. How did you pick which ones? Salt and Pepper, it and would Cher, fl- and it, Diana
We'd be in the
Ross,
writing room and we would say, we'd set up the moment well, this should be, and he'd go, ooh, Pretty Poison.
Yeah.
And he'd just stand up. And anytime he stood up and started doing it, we would just type, well, that's the song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty.
I've always.
Catch Me, I'm Falling.
Catch Me, I'm Falling by the group Pretty Poison. There was a one-hit wonder. I don't even know if it was a actually a hit.
It is now.
It is now. But I, you know, I've always got music going in my head. Music is my life. And you talk about, you know, what drives me out of bed every day. It is music. It's rhythm. And so that song has always been a stripper fantasy for me. If I were ever a stripper, it would be Catch Me, I'm Falling by Pretty Poison. But we got lots of music, lots of dancing, lots of a roller coaster of emotions in this show. And it was important to both of us to do that, because the things that I keep going back to, you know, like the movie Grease or The Wizard of Oz, the things that I can watch it all the time, have these tentpole moments, whether it's musical, whether it's emotional, whether it's sadness, that you can sort of dip the needle onto these different places and go back to it and revisit it. And that's what this show has. It has it runs the gamut of emotions, and it does it really well.
Mm-hmm. Great cast of characters too, which I loved. All the
there's so many outsider elements to this.
So good. Lou is the cop. Oh my god!
And then we have the kid. But we have Tia Carrera. Here's a rude thing. I was like, well, the villain is the ex boyfriend, and I said he's going to chase them. We have to have someone with him, so he's not just doing scenes of him looking mean in a car, and I go, we need a sidekick, and Rue just looks at me and goes, well, maybe there's a woman named Lady Danger who does illegal pumping parties in the drag clubs, and instead of saline, she pumps motor oil, and I was like, yes. Yes.
Keep going.
And then it was like, and then she screwed up her face and she has an eye patch on. Yes. I have to spell check everything you just said because I just threw it up on my computer, but I can't even take time to spell. But literally, those moments where I'm like, from the narrative, what are we going to do? And he goes, only he would say, you know, she pumps motor oil instead of saline.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Fun.
Did you guys know each other in the late 80s and 90s in New York?
No, we met at
Charing Cross. I walked by the pier a couple of times. And
yeah, I was probably
his
there.
His old stomping ground.
Yeah, I was probably there. But we met through Allie Willis at one of her backyard parties. Yeah, out here.
But no, of course I knew Rue. I mean, you can't not be in New York. You know, everybody. That's why we're here, by the way.
I'll never forget that Matt campaign. Yeah. It was as if I was just starting off and working and in New York City, money making Manhattan. Uh-huh. And it was like, what? It was just incredible.
Yeah, yeah. And that was, I didn't really.
That was huge when you think about that at that time. It was. 1993, 94.
Yeah. But, you know, I had been working and stomping around New York and nightclubs and stuff for 11 years before anything happened with my career, before I got the record deal at Tommy Boy in 92. And so for 11 years before that, I had been, you know, doing my thing and terrorizing y'all's neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and the other thing is, I'm so glad we didn't until now.
Right.
I'm so glad we didn't till now.
Yeah.
Because it's really important that when you get to a certain level of, I'm going to say surety in what you do, you're so sure of what you do, that it really takes someone that you already know that they're special to, I hate to say this, but to be able to listen. Mm-hmm. You got to have someone who's already got as much, or else somebody who's just crazy, like a 20-year-old that you think, I don't know, they're from another planet, whatever they say, we're putting in. Mm-hmm. But the idea of the vetting of each other through our careers, that if he said something to me, I'd be like, well, he knows. And I'm hoping there are moments where he would think, well, he knows.
Absolutely.
So you don't have to think, am I the right one? Mm-hmm. You're both right. Now what? So I'm really happy. Plus, I don't think unless I did this show, I would ever have the relationship I have with Rue. Our relationship is so naked emotionally and close because of the dream we came up with and then did, that I feel so blessed that I feel like I have a special relationship with Rue.
You do.
I do.
Yeah.
And that is something that's a big deal to me.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, and I'll say it again, to be able to play with someone who is as talented and outrageous and passionate and emotionally present is such a gift. You just, most people, to survive in this world, not just Hollywood, you have to shut everything off. You got to shut it off. And to be with someone so present. And this man on the set, he is screaming, he's laughing, he's crying,
he's bipolar.
He's out there. He's got his computer on the set writing. He's there. He's writing. He's doing it. And that gives us all permission to also do that and feel it's a safe place to do that. Mm-hmm. You know. And I know that I have been so gifted with this thing. In fact, because of all of this, somehow we've been able to channel this really beautiful show, and on every level. And we get together and go, how are we able to pull that off? You know, there's the technical stuff, but then there's the ethereal God stuff that just entered into this project. Like even the kid who we haven't spoken enough about, because this kid, my goodness.
Izzy G.
Even in the audition, we had the chemistry
energy
together. It was like, oh my goodness. And so it goes back to that there is another unseen force at work here. Mm-hmm. That's why we know that this is a gift to not just America, but to the world, to remind us to sort of, it's an alignment. It's an emotional alignment for the world to get us back in shape.
It was very important to show a little white girl and a tall black man holding hands and going across the country. To me, that was important.
Yeah.
It was important that element be subliminally seen. It just was.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about them holding hands on camera is one thing, but they also held hands in life. Because despite their vastly different lives to that point, they were both newbies in this show.
Yeah.
And he was doing something he'd never done, and she was doing something she'd never done. And I'd be directing, and I'd hear I'd have the headphones on, and they'd be wired, and I could hear them talking, and they'd be rehearsing, and he wouldn't know a line, and she'd say, "You're doing good. You're doing good." And then I would hear them say before action, "Okay, hold my hand, let's go." And then he would snap her out of being 10 every now and then. He'd say, quick sticks,
yeah,
like, let's get it together. The teacher's coming. But literally, they were jumping out of a plane together.
Yeah.
And they were the parachutes for each other.
I want to take you guys back to the beginning a little bit here for our listeners. And both of you had kind of touched on it. You are scrappy. You came from nowhere, Scranton, Pennsylvania, San Diego, then Atlanta. You didn't grow up in an environment that would lend itself towards this kind of entertainment success necessarily, from what I've read and what I know from you, Michael. Obviously, Rue, you were told you were going to be famous maybe from birth. Maybe that had some effect. I mean, they say that that does a little bit if you tell, they manifest destiny or whatever. What advice would you give, or what do you tell people, like in the middle of the country where you travel in the show, basically, that don't have access, that don't live on the coast, that don't have money or connections? Like, both of you knew you were performers. You knew you had to get out. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. You knew you had to get out.
I would say we knew we had to let something out.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And
absolutely.
I mean, I was not told I was famous. Mm-hmm. I was going to be famous, which, of course, maybe is the best thing you could say to someone. You're not going to be famous. Mm-hmm. I think the thing anywhere, it's already there. It's already in them. That's the thing. Wherever you are in the middle of the country or Timbuktu, it's whatever is in you that would maybe direct you to this exalted place of getting to create and shape spirit so people could feel something. It's already in you. The hard journey, and you do it all the time when you hold up those pictures of the drag queens and say, talk to your 7-year-old. The hard part is allowing it to come out. And I'm not talking about your sexuality. That's sometimes true too, but mm-hmm. your mad vision of who you think you can be, your spirit. Yes.
You're absolutely right. Everyone is born with a transmitter, a beacon. And your job is to clear a space for that beacon to shine through. It's a frequency that you align yourself with. And what happens is through stillness, through a lot of time alone, both of us watched a lot of television and spent a lot of time alone creating that magic. What you do is in that quiet time, and even if, you know, the middle of nowhere, you know, it's, you find that light. That light starts to shine brighter. And that's the light that will carry you through some of the darker moments. Because even when, you know, you do find out what you want to do. And I remember being out here in L.A. at 28, sleeping on my sister's couch, my younger sister's couch, not a dime to my name. And I had, even in those dark times, was able to rely back on that light.
The belief. And it's abstract, but it's very loud when you're young. And it doesn't have to be about performing. You see some kid all of a sudden says, I'm going to be a geography. I'm going to write maps.
Yeah.
You know, there's something there that if they're allowed to be that, and even if you're not allowed, if you mm-hmm. listen or if you're very blessed, it's so strong you almost can't deny it.
That's right.
I mean, I went to New York when I was 20, and I still didn't have my rent when I was 38. I was still in New York doing everything I could. There was no reason anyone was like saying, you know, that's a good plan.
Yeah.
But I felt this thing, this vibration in me that needed to be recognized. And you could say need is complicated and maybe wrong, but it needs to be dealt with. And it gets you through sleeping on your sister's couch at 28 or 38, going hiding from your landlord and thinking, I have something to say.
Yeah.
That's the same. I say right now, I say I'm exactly the same as I was at 7, mm-hmm. but with a little bit more skill. Mm-hmm. My mother used to tell me I had a natural, crazy instinct to put on a show in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I would put picnic tables together. Put the stairs, they were my thing, put on a pageant, do something, a pageant, here
uh-huh,
we are.
Uh-huh.
The last show in the AJ and the Queen is a pageant.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But my mother had three gowns in the attic. Her wedding gown, her bridesmaid's gown from her sister, and her bridesmaid's gown from her best friend, and they were in a zippered bag. That was my costume department. So I would go up and get those dresses and put them on my three sisters and force them to walk around, and then I would pull lampshades and whatever else I could do to make the set. My mother got to the point where she would say to me, Michael, I'm going downtown. When I leave this house, do not go up in that attic and pull out all those dresses and put on a show. Do not. And I'd go, okay. The door would close and it would be like, I was compelled to pull the dresses out even though I knew I was going to get in trouble and put on a show. And I realized even on this show when they were saying to me, Michael, this budget is too big. You are not going to be able to do everything you want. You need to get the budget. You need to cut stuff. And I'd be like, and then we would do it because I saw the show. So basically my mother was my first studio.
Yes.
Is the point. But it's in you.
Yeah.
If you're lucky and you're pure and you're not in a crisis situation, if your family isn't, if you're not worried about your food or your safety, there is a moment where you can play with the idea of, hey, what's that? What's that?
Right,
is that who I am?
Right. You know, again, like Michael, I was compelled to do it. And, you know, drag was something that sort of fell on my lap. And I thought, what am I going to do with this? I'll do it if I can pay my rent or, you know, get some drink tickets.
You are gorgeous.
Thank you. But I never thought, you know, my thinking was, oh, I'll be David Bowie and I will, I'll start a rock band and I'll do Andrade sort of David Bowie thing. That'll be the way I do it. But as I went down the road, drag happened to me. And I took note. And that's where that creating a space and listening to that voice inside saying, no, this is something you can really do well. So I tucked it to the side. And then when I finally wanted to work above 14th Street and go mainstream, I thought, well, I'll have to do my David Bowie thing. Then it occurred to me, who said that you can't do this thing in drag? And I thought, oh, I said that. It was implanted in my head. So once I made space for another thought and cleared out that old directive, it was like ancient doors of the universe started to creak open. Like I had said, the you know, it was open sesame, these secret words. And those words were in my own head. The adjustment was me. The world didn't have to adjust. I had to adjust and be open to what the universe's stage direction had for
that's,
me.
That's mm-hmm. so important. I call it the green lights, following the green lights.
Following yeah. the green
Look
lights.
Where they are.
Yeah.
Where yes. are the green lights? Don't go to the right. red lights. Where are the right. yellow lights? Green lights. And all of a sudden, it's like, you could be David Bowie, but look what's happening when you're in drag.
That's right.
Green lights.
Green lights.
Smiles.
Green lights.
I see it as smiles. Openness. Yes. The universe is telling you, go that way. We yes. like that.
Yes. That's but, right.
Well, it's interesting that you guys were doing that all also before social media. Uh-huh. Because I feel like, and I know I'm sure we could have a whole other podcast about how we feel about social media, but at that specific time, it was really before, you know, certainly ages before Instagram, which I mm-hmm. think has kind of killed a little bit of the creative spirit.
Yeah.
At the same time, it's given so many people outlets for creativity.
Yeah.
But I think about all the stuff that you were doing, if you were putting that on social media, your struggles, or mm-hmm. you know, would you have your own YouTube show about trying to
well,
make
you know,
it?
Here's
would
the you... big, here's yeah. the bigger Zen question: if you're getting lots of random likes, does it stop your need for the big like?
Mm.
If you put up a meme where you're like, blah, 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 or you're a GIF or you're funny, and you get mm-hmm. 500 people for no reason just decide, you're funny, you're doing mm-hmm. your uncle, he's drunk,
mm-hmm.
and you get 500 likes. Does that feed the beast too much so that you're getting maybe a third of the way where you would get if you were not getting it?
Mm-hmm.
And I was in a writing room, not on this show, but on another show that I had, and I had 27-year-olds, and I would tell them that their scripts needed to be better. And of course, they do the first, what at that time was the millennial shift. Well, I'm sorry, it didn't work for you.
Right, right.
No, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, it didn't work for you. And not to be like the old man of the sea, but I was like, there's a rule, I'm in charge, and it's got to work. And I remember, I started on Murphy Brown with Diane English. If she had told me a script didn't work, it would have been the end of like, I don't know, the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. I would have, the lightning would have shot through my body and I would have melted like the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm telling these young writers with my background and my history, my mm-hmm. great largeness, mm-hmm. it doesn't work. And they're like, mm-hmm. And then I thought, it's because they're going to go out of here and get 500 likes.
Right.
They yeah. don't need my like.
Yeah.
There's no deficit of people liking them for doing a 2-minute blah, blah, blah on their phone.
Right.
So I don't know. I don't know if what social, I know it does propel an enormous amount of conversation
mm-hmm.
and thrills arts. I mean, TikTok is like, oh, look at the fish has mm-hmm. a wife.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. But I don't know what it does to the actual need. It's a very big question, but you're talking to an Irish Catholic who's, you know, it's like need is like, you know, I need more of, the hole has to be filled. So I don't know. I don't know what social media does to, if it's a desert and you just keep going till you hit water, a big oasis, is that the journey to become big? Or is it like there's little water cups each way so you don't even go to the oasis?
Yeah, yeah. I think that it's, I think we can all agree, I think it's a false value system that doesn't really sustain you, because it's like, you know, it's like eating some empty calories, you know, it doesn't say, because the truth is a lot of what we do in our art has to do with how the human emotional system reacts to these elements, you know, and these elements are real. And humans haven't changed that much. We like to believe that we're advanced and that, you know, young people like to believe that they invented the hookup or the blow job. And we all know that, you know, Joan Crawford invented those things. But the human hasn't changed as much as the ego will let you believe, lead you to believe it has. We are still a very primitive, emotionally primitive culture. And just because you got some likes here or you got a smartphone there, the truth is we're not that different. We really are not that different than what we were before. You know, I don't know all the things that my phone can do. I don't care.
I know how we are different than we were before. The phones have affected how we view things, see things, sit still and watch something. So that's what I'm interested in social media. How does it affect your ability as an audience,
right,
to sit and take in the journey that two people have put together for you? How does it affect, are you able to go in the RV with AJ and the Queen? Mm-hmm. Or do you not let go of your phone to go on the journey?
Right.
And I'm talking in bigger pictures as well as macro, micro things, which is like, what's a pace of a show now?
Mm-hmm.
Do you play with the pace? Do you listen to the pace? Do you just do stuff? We were scoring the show. It's so interesting. The world is very noisy.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like one of the great, I think, lessons or treats of working with Rue. It was like, how much music do you put on the show now? Like, how much music do you put into the body of a narrative? Like, do you wall-to-wall music because people need to be held their attentions? So there was one scene and we were wondering whether we should put music in. So I had the composer. It was a kind of an interesting scene. The composer put music in. Rue hadn't seen it with the music or without. I played in the scene and he looks at it and he goes, with the music, and he goes, uh-huh, I get it, but why would I ever watch that scene again? I know exactly what I'm supposed to feel. And he said, I watch stuff to figure out how I participate with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. If we're telling people all the time what to feel because it's easier and we're worried that they won't be able to let go of phones, like, what does that do to storytelling?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we were talking about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, how that rhythm and that pace is so beautiful and so luxurious.
Brad Pitt.
Yeah. Oh my God.
Brad Pitt.
Oh, there's all of that too.
You know what it is? It's like. Remember Pac-Man? Like, you're going along, and all of a sudden you get the power pellet. Boop, 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 boop. Yeah. Brad Pitt takes off his shirt. Yes. Oh, I'm good for two more hours.
Yeah. Well, but you know,
all's right with the world.
All's right.
That's, you know, I want the journey. I don't watch television with the smartphone in my hand. It's not my thing.
All right, I have time for one more question for you guys. What are you both, this is to each of you individually, what are you both obsessed with that we would be surprised to learn?
I have been doing a dance with the devil, which is called the YouTube algorithm. I will put in a topic I like it started with when I watched Fosse Verdon. And I was like, what is Michelle Williams doing? How did she know to do that? How is that an essence of Gwen Verdon? I didn't know enough about Gwen Verdon. So I have the big TV with Apple TV and all that, and I put in Gwen Verdon. So up comes a click. Oh, here's Gwen Verdon talking. All right, so okay, that's what she did. Then I go away. Next time I go to my television, there's two things of Gwen Verdon and Gwen Verdon on the Tonys. So it's this weird Whitman chocolate sampler.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm surprised that I'm so interested in, a machine showing me something wonderful that I didn't know was out there. So that's the good version. So that's what's interesting. Sometimes when I don't want to watch a narrative, I put on YouTube and I go, what's the old algorithm going to, oh, really? Charles Pierce did a whole show about turbines? Like, and then, of course, you know, if you hit it, you're getting Charles Pierce for a week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if that's what I think is surprising about me as somebody who writes a narrative, participating in the opposite of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. You know, I don't think people would be surprised at my obsession with music and with certain, you know, I've always been obsessed with the Brothers Gibb, the Bee Gees, and I delve into their catalog, into their production, into how they fool with the time signature of a song, and it just gives
me amazing. That is shocking.
It gives me
you're staying alive.
Love. Analyzing the Bee Gees catalog.
Analyze, but I've always done it. It's not. I think people know that I'm obsessed with music. If they
sure,
you know, but I'm still amazed by them, and I think about Barry Gibb a lot because he's the only one left. His whole family, mm-hmm. you know, and just their music in general. It sends me. I could start crying thinking about it and what it does. So that's what
it's interesting.
I
had Paul Rudd in here a couple weeks ago, and we talked extensively about the Bee Gees. He also is a huge Bee Gees fan, and my favorite album, like ever, soundtrack is "Staying Alive."
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
It's a great soundtrack.
Yeah.
You know, it's perfection. But, you know, they have the 60s right. Bee Gees. They have the 70s when they were with Arif Martin and doing their soul music, and then which led to the disco. And then after, in the 80s, when they were producing all these other people, Barbara Streisand, Kenny Rogers, Dionne Warwick, you know, Olivia Newton-John, Diana Ross, it just goes on and on and on. It's brilliant.
See, I'm surprised that you get into a helicopter and enjoy it. That was shocking to me.
Yeah.
You enjoy that lack of control of being in a helicopter.
Well, I'm a controlling person. So I've had to practice allowing myself to do that. I've had a lot of dental work done. So you have to be able to be open to allow and trust. And, you know, that's what happened with Michael. And I knew even from when I did the guest spot on The Comeback, I thought, there's one. There's someone I can trust.
You're the helicopter pilot.
Yes.
And the dentist.
Yes. Yeah.
I love it. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Is it safe?
Yeah.
Is it safe?
It is with you.
Oh, my God.
Marathon Man reference.
I love it. Well, thank you, guys.
Oh, my God.
Everybody go watch AJ and the Queen. It's so great. And here's the thing. People, they may be watching with their phones, but they're watching a lot.
Yeah.
Because binging. Who knew binging? Who knew someone could sit for three? I think the average time is like 3 hours. People binge stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when we tested it, they tested it, and they tested it with the young kids. And I turned to the testers and I said, so when are you going to let them take their phones in?
Uh-huh.
Because then that's how they watch TV.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
there won't be a pace problem because they'll be texting their friends going, oh my God, did you just see that? And they participate with it. So that I get. I love the idea of participating with it.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
As long as you're with it.
It's great. Well, congrats, guys. Thanks so much for joining me. AJ and the Queen is streaming now on Netflix. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast wherever you've been listening. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Krista Smith. Join me next time for more meaningful conversations here at Present Company.